special bonus installment of the Pop Dose podcast. My name is Mike Duquette. I'm one of the contributors to Pop Dose, and we have a special treat for you on this very special episode. Now, this should be coming to you around June 25th, which would mark 2 years to the day that Michael Jackson passed away. For all his eccentricities as a performer and a celebrity, his worldwide impact on pop culture cannot be understated. And while the world may have gone to exalting him in death, back to merely appreciating his gifts, pop cultural junkies will never run out of things to say about him. It's in that spirit that Jeff Giles, our beloved editor-in-chief, allowed us to record this special episode for you. And since we at Popdose are as big fans of gimmicks as we are of pop culture, we have a loose theme within a theme for you today, one that will provide as much enlightenment as confusion. Here to join us in our discussion on Michael Jackson are another two of Popdose's Michaels, Mike Holliger and Michael Parr. Gentlemen.
Hello.
Howdy.
And we're also joined by another guest, not a Michael, but as big a fan of the King of Pop as they come, Zach Stigler, who contributes to Mike's own Pop Blurred blog. Zach, good to have you with us.
Fantastic to be here, gentlemen.
Excellent. I guess it's best to start at the beginning. You know, we all, of course, probably come from very different perspectives in our appreciation of Michael Jackson, and I think it would be fun to sort of start, and fill everyone in on where we're coming from. And whoever would like to start is okay with me. Mike, perhaps you.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
or me.
No.
Wait, are we going to do this again? Come on, party. You want to go first this time?
No, you can go first.
You sure? Age before beauty.
No. It's quite all right.
So basically, I mean, I became aware of Michael Jackson at a very, very young age. As I've said before, a lot of my initial interest in Michael Jackson was pretty narcissistic, I guess, as one would expect from like a 3 or 4 year old, who turns on the TV or puts on a record player and sees people going crazy over this other person named Michael. Initially I think it was sort of that, and from there things just kind of snowballed. My early youth sort of coincided with the off-the-wall Triumph Thriller period, so it was pretty easy to kind of get caught up in that, in that pop culture moment and, fall in love with the music and fall in love with the person behind the music as well. So that's sort of how I got started.
Excellent. Michael, how about you?
My introduction came via the Saturday morning cartoons that I mentioned earlier. You can all remember, some of you might remember.
I actually,
the older of you among the band.
I remember them in reruns, actually. I remember they ran during the week, right around the time Thriller was popular. They ran the Jackson 5 cartoon.
That's nuts. But the Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 cartoon, they did the whole thing, the Scooby-Doo adventures, Scooby-Doo-style adventures. Michael and his brothers would get in all sorts of trouble, and it was comic relief, and then they'd do the big musical number at the end. It was pure, Hanna-Barbera-esque fun. But that was my first, introduction. I grew up in a non-Motown, Barry Manilow, country western loving household, so there was very little exposure for me to Motown, just bits and pieces here and there. But I would say that, the first time I became truly aware was Billie Jean. That was, kind of groundbreaking stuff, and the dancing and the light up floors and all of it, was where I was hooked, and that was it.
Now, Michael, you mentioned the Jackson 5 show. I don't think I've ever seen an episode in full. You sort of compared it to Scooby-Doo. Did they have a van?
No, I think they had like a dune buggy.
Even better than that.
I don't remember. Don't quote me on that, because it's been a long time since I've seen it. It's got to be out there on YouTube. It has to be.
Yeah, and you can probably pick up.
I'm sure it'll
be
on a DVD set soon.
Maybe you can probably get on like bootleg DVD or something like that too.
I've admittedly never been desperate enough to check.
Well, hadn't it?
No, you should check it
Now's
out.
Now's your
it's,
chance.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's worth it. Even if it's just for, pure silliness to see what the old man's talking about.
Well, I know exactly what I'm getting you for your birthday, Michael.
Now. Oh, no.
And Zach, how about you? How did you get into Michael Jackson?
Well, I mean, I'm a child of the 80s, so therefore I'm also a cliche of the 80s. And my first awareness was absolutely the Thriller album. I don't remember at what point, you know, what the first track I heard was. All I remember was my mom had gotten the Thriller LP through the Columbia House Record Club. and we listened to it all the time, you know, and that hooked me from, you know, the age of, what, 2 when we got it? So, yeah, my story's not very interesting, sorry.
Well, unlike these guys, I have a rather unusual story as to how I got into Michael Jackson, because my awareness of Michael Jackson did not dovetail with his period of popularity. If you haven't guessed yet, I'm markedly younger than most of the Popdos readers and audience, I'd probably say. I first came into awareness of Michael Jackson in middle school, which at that point was about 2000, 2001. I'm sort of awaiting the gasps of horror.
We're groaning silently.
Yeah.
You can't hear my eyes roll.
But I sort of came into awareness of him in a really unique way, because since his popularity had already considered to have peaked at the time, there was this established foundation of, well, his output, you know, stood the test of time. So while I didn't get to see him sort of create that, I sort of got to view it from a distance, and I gotta say, it's just as impressive from that vantage point as I imagine it probably would be in 1983 or 1984, hearing those singles on the radio and, you know, sort of admiring the videos, rushing home from school, you know, from school to catch them on MTV or whatever. You know, of course, you know, I had VH1, you know, like some sort of, like, documentary or something. But I, for some reason, responded to it as well as anyone of my own age would have responded to, I guess, the TRL acts that were popular at the time. And, you know, I've said before, I think it was probably because he was so popular. I mean, when I was growing up, my favorite forms of entertainment were all the crowd pleasers. You know, my favorite movies were always, like, you know, blockbusters like Star Wars or E.T. or Jaws or anything like that. So, I guess, sort of stumbling upon a musical equivalent of that, something that was so big and so far-reaching, I guess I just naturally gravitated toward that. And it's, you know, it's something I've still kept with me. You know?
I don't mean to, you know, underscore your statement, but just to clarify, you did say, like, 2001, 2002?
Yeah, it was a little bit before that, probably. Maybe,
okay.
Like,
But, I mean, that raises actually a really interesting point to me. And to some extent, you know, so much of the, what we consider, quote-unquote, you know, 80s music, whether it's the One Hit Wonders or the sort of more the established canon of 80s music, is very, can't escape that label, right? Or can't escape that sort of confinement of being a product of the 80s. But, I mean, your experience, and also, you know, my girlfriend has taught in middle school in Baltimore for 6 or 7 years. And, you know, kids that are, you know, 12, 13, 14, you know, are all still getting into Michael Jackson, you know, like the classic stuff and the new stuff. It's just really interesting to me that he has somehow been able to, his work has been able to sort of overcome that age barrier really effectively.
I think part of that is if you listen to the radio now, you're going to hear stuff that sounds very similar to the music that Michael Jackson was putting out in the 80s. And there's no, it doesn't sound dated, because if you turn on the radio now, you're going to hear the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And there may have even been a sort of a direct line even at the time, because I remember, you know, maybe not too long after that, Invincible came out, and I remember Michael had those couple concerts at Madison Square Garden, and he had pretty much everybody who was on TRL at the time, NSYNC and Britney Spears and artists like that, came out to, you know, do support for him and sing songs and be a part of that experience. And, you know, I guess it's, you know, I don't know. I never responded to it at the time. Like, oh yeah, they're, you know, they're directly influenced by him. I wasn't that omnipotent as far as pop culture was concerned. But I must also say the counterpoint, Zach, is that my general pop cultural tastes are approximately 25 years out of date.
Which means you're right in line with the rest of us.
Well, but, yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, because it wasn't...
I'll tell you a little story, Zach. The first time I met Mike Duquette, he was wearing an AHA t-shirt. Not at all, ironically.
No, not at all.
I'm surprised you can even find an AHA t-shirt.
I went to see him on tour. When they were doing that that farewell tour, it rolled through New York City, and I took my girlfriend, and we were probably the youngest people there at, you know, 23 and 24.
I wouldn't doubt that.
That's very often the case. I think we went to see Genesis, and I think it was the same thing. You know, it was like everyone was like in their, at least in their 30s or 40s.
Careful there.
Yeah, I know, right?
Sorry.
I went to that Genesis show. Careful.
And of course, I bought an Invisible Touch T-shirt from that show. So I have no shame, no shame.
Nothing wrong with that.
So, I guess once you became established fans of Michael, the three of you, what do you think was the point where it was like, holy cow, this is someone I'm gonna want to really stick around with? Like, was there a song or an album or even a video or just any sort of particular moment that really made Michael stick out more than anyone else? And Mike,
I'll jump in.
Sure, yeah.
Again, you know, I was born in 81, so I sort of just got on the gravy train, you know. Didn't sort of miss out on the earlier period, but certainly lived through the Thriller mania and all of that, and that was huge. But as far as establishing sort of a fandom relationship, it really was the Bad era that was for me the sort of moment. I think part of it was, you know, as big as Thriller was and as big as he was at that time, I sort of felt like, in retrospect at least, by the time Bad came out, that his celebrity superstar status already having been established, he was able to play it up to excess, you know? And as a 8 or 9 year old kid during that era, you know, there was this, and certainly the Pepsi commercials played this up too, but right, there was a sort of magic, you know, about Michael Jackson, is his music and his dancing and his showmanship, and it was sort of a mythical figure, right? And of course, like, one of the big aha moments of that for me, this is sort of embarrassing, but was seeing Captain EO at Disney World. I mean, being that age and seeing, you know, Michael Jackson in 3D, it was like, oh my god, this is the most incredible thing ever. And that was when I sort of like, I walked out of, you know, Captain EO in 1987 or 88, whatever it was, like he is the fucking coolest.
Which is, oddly enough, exactly what I said walking out of Captain EO, I think it was like 3 or 4 months ago, because they bought it back after he passed. Disney World, and we went on a family vacation, and I sort of dragged everybody, my parents and my brother. And they're like, and my brother in particular was, you know, he has a pretty wide palate of taste, but he's like, really? We gotta go see this? And I will say, from a, you know, 20-something's perspective, it's awful. It's just terrible. But there's something oddly endearing about it.
And I have not seen Captain EO.
I think, Mike, didn't I excitedly text you after I...
I think you did. I think you did. I think you did.
And, but Zach, it's funny that you mention the Bad era, because that's actually exactly the same for me. And as I was saying to Mike and Michael earlier, what I like about that record so much is that it's very conscious of its popular aspirations. You know, I think Thriller, of course, Thriller, biggest album of all time, you know, commercially, and I think Michael and Quincy Jones and everyone involved did seek out to make a record like that. But mm-hmm. I think Bad, they multiplied that by about 1,000.
Well, I mean, it's all context. I mean, like I said, I keep saying, we all keep saying, like I said earlier, but I mean, you know, if Bad was Thriller on steroids the same way Thriller was Off the Wall on steroids. I mean, there were just varying degrees of reach, you know, because when Thriller was being made, I don't think, you know, Michael and Quincy really knew that the success that Thriller would eventually obtain was going to be possible. They were looking to match and potentially surpass the success of Off the Wall. So they made an album with the idea of consciously exceeding that success in mind. Whereas Thriller set this, like, ginormous benchmark, and Bad was made to succeed Thriller. So it was just sort of like one was like the building block for the other, and, you know, so on and so forth.
On that same page, though, do you think that the records after
that... I was just going to say that.
Because they were still reaching. I mean, let's face it. I was in music retail at the time when History came out.
As was I.
And I remember the package, and I remember it was one of the first of its kind where it was, hey, I'm giving you an album of greatest hits, and I'm giving you a new record. And oh, by the way, it's really expensive at the time.
Right. Still is when you think about it. Yeah. I've seen it for, you know, like 30. I think I end up buying a used copy because I...
Yeah, it's, you know, it stands as a pretty expensive set.
Right.
And people still bought it in droves.
That's true.
And people, and it didn't matter that you were coming in and you were buying, you know, there weren't even extended versions or anything like that. It was just the, you know, it was the Beat It off of Thriller, note for note. No,
right.
You know, no extended versions,
right.
No nothing. It was just greatest hits material.
Right.
And I think even, you know, even by then, you know, do you think that, and the hubbub surrounding it, right? Uh-huh. Because that was, by that point, it was, you know, there's the giant statue of Michael floating down the river. And, you know, do you think that it was a conscious thing after Thriller that each had to be that much bigger?
Yeah. I mean, I think the law of diminishing returns kicked in. I mean, I think... with Bad, Michael was trying to make an album that would be as big as Thriller. And then with the albums after that, I think Michael was just trying to make albums that would be bigger than the albums that came before him, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you read a lot of the interviews or even just sort of literature around his career, and that's sort of the common denominator is, you know, he was always trying to one-up himself and always trying to replicate, you know, how do you even... attempt to replicate the you know the biggest album of all time, but
and that's
that
the
was
thing.
Sort of his mindset,
right?
And the byproduct of that was he once, especially after Quincy left the picture, lacked someone to tell him no,
right?
Yeah,
right.
It's interesting because you draw that parallel with a lot of artists, especially a certain one that's near and dear to me. The minute they lose that person to tell them no. Is usually when things like diminishing returns start coming into play.
Michael, who on earth could you be talking about?
I have no idea.
He wouldn't happen to be from Minneapolis, would he?
Maybe.
Paul Westerberg.
Possibly.
If we...
That's right.
Bob Dylan?
Perhaps I needed a better signal.
Springsteen, come on, guys.
No, but you're absolutely right, and I've said before, and I think Mike sort of has a different take on this. I was intrigued by hearing his take, but I think, especially with Dangerous, I've always said that Dangerous is the moment where he stopped setting the trends and started kind of following them.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. Just by the sheer inclusion of Slash.
And Heavy D.
But, I mean...
And Heavy D.
I mean, think about it, though. I mean, at that time... I mean, A, Heavy D was not a major pop star by any stretch of the imagination. You know, Teddy Riley wasn't a major pop producer by any stretch of the imagination. I mean...
Nah.
Teddy Riley has some big, heavy
but it wasn't like, you know, like if he made a record with like Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, or if he made a record with like Babyface or something like that. I mean, Teddy Riley was, you know, reasonably popular, but he was also sort of like the, you know, sort of like the riskier version of those type of big like pop producers.
Yeah. Wasn't he on? Was he on Boyz II Men's Cool High Harmony?
He was not.
Okay, I'm thinking.
He was not. No.
I don't know why I'm thinking of that he was. Maybe he did some remixes or something. After
I don't
the fact.
Think so. I don't think so, but I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, he definitely sort of lost a little bit of the trend-setting, you know, quality that he had. But I mean, if you take a listen to what was on the radio what was on top 40 radio in 1991 and 1992, I mean, Dangerous was still a little bit ahead of its time. Like, it came right before before R&B really took sort of control of the of pop culture.
You know, you're right, and the other thing I'll say here is that while he might have stepped back musically, it was becoming more of an all around multimedia thing.
Absolutely.
Because if you think about the videos associated with Dangerous, that's where you get into the truly groundbreaking stuff. You know, Black and White, and then oh gosh, what was the other one?
Remember the time.
Yeah,
Jam.
You know, like. Yeah, Jam. You get into those things, and it's all of a sudden it's a totally different ball game. You know, it's where the genesis of, you know, inspiration for artists like Gaga. You know, you have to see as well as hear to understand what the message is. It's not, you're not going to get it just from listening to it. You have to actually see.
But
it.
But the only thing I'll say to that, what makes it sort of disappointing, is that it always felt a little bit more forced. I mean, I think. He certainly had that mindset on Thriller and Bad with those videos. And even though Bad starts to get toward the hammy side, you know, especially anyone who's seen Moonwalker can attest to that. But I particularly think of Remember the Time, and it's like, really? Like, he's in Egypt? And it just doesn't make any sense.
There was definitely more of a sort of focus to be conceptual. Like, I mean, when Billie Jean and Beat It came out, there wasn't a bar to be set. By the time Dangerous rolled around, a bar had been set, and he wanted to equal or surpass that bar.
But
so,
it doesn't feel to me like he's trying to jump at that bar. It's like he's just trying to throw stuff. I mean, I think, wasn't it Randy Tarabrelli's book that, I guess, when he made the transition to hire Frank DeLeo as his manager, I thought one of the things that Frank had said was that, I guess, his previous managers had suggested a Robin Hood themed video for Beat It.
Right.
And it
right,
was,
I remember that.
Like, who on earth?
Thank God.
Imagine what would have been, you know, him like.
Imagine a comedy.
Just shooting arrows.
Imagine the tights.
Oh God.
And Eddie Van Halen in like Ren Faire gear. You know, like shredding.
Oh, stop. Steve Luthaker with a Justice
yes.
hat on.
Oh, God.
But I think that's a really good point about, you know, the Dangerous being sort of the moment where it becomes not just about the record or even just about the videos, but it becomes about this sprawling mass or multimedia experience, right? I mean, keep in mind, these things were all tied in. The premieres were tied into, like, tacked on at the end of The Simpsons.
Yep.
There was the HBO concert that went on at the same time. There's more merchandising going on. And so much of that stuff seems almost sort of standard now, right? And the premieres were happening on multiple networks simultaneously. It was this big event.
Right.
Then, of course, the controversy that surrounded some of the videos, right?
Of course.
Now it seems so passé, but.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, how many people have the original version of They Don't Really Care About Us, right? It's
oh, yeah.
Before I actually, the edited version.
Well,
yeah.
I did, because I was one of the people that I bought History at Midnight on the day it came out. Yeah, same.
Right,
here. And I was working at a record store at the time, so I was sort of a captive audience anyway. But I lost that copy, and my recent copy has the offending words struck from the mix.
My copy still is, you know, has the thing that I wouldn't repeat.
The offending words,
yes.
The thing that probably cost him brownie points with Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
I'm not writing a movie for you anymore.
That's the real reason the E.T. storybook isn't on CD.
Oh. I just got a copy of that off of eBay.
on vinyl?
Yeah, with the poster and everything.
I'm immensely jealous. As both a,
I've yet to listen to it, but
as both an MJ fan and an E.T. fan, that's like
you don't want to listen to it. It's pretty difficult to listen to.
I've heard pieces of it on YouTube, and really? It's like
it's his high affected voice, and it's so dramatic.
The thing I remember is like he's describing like when E.T. finds the Reese's Pieces, and like just the words that he says, like they can be so misconstrued. Like he put the small object into his mouth.
Oh boy.
Back when, yeah.
I mean, and to go back to Dangerous too for a second, I mean, it's really easy now, even with the sort of rejuvenated interest in his work after his death. It's, you know, Dangerous is sort of looked at as the beginning of the end. And to some degree it is, but you know, I think it's really easy to forget that was still a huge fucking deal when it came out.
Yeah,
that's true.
And that was a midnight sale. You know, it was this hugely anticipated, and the singles all did really well. You know, I just want to get that out there.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah, that was a huge record. I remember, I remember not picking it up at midnight, but not long after. It was a huge record.
Yeah.
Bigger than probably any others, you know, in or around that time.
And plus, I guess because I feel really guilty, like I'm, you know, sort of shitting on the MJ stuff post-Bad. But I will say that none of those releases after Bad are completely inessential. You know, I think there's moments of greatness on all of them.
You know,
Blood on the Dance Floor.
I mean, but that's not a real album.
No, it's not.
I mean, Dangerous, you know, I've always said Dangerous would be a fantastic album if you cut, like, 3 songs from it.
Many people that I'm friendly with have said the same thing about Invincible.
Yeah, I would say the same thing about Invincible, absolutely.
If you cut and then remixed...
Yeah, I agree.
There's a stretch towards the end of Invincible that's intolerable. If you remove that stuff, it's a pretty good album.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way about, like, Keep the Faith from Dangerous.
I mean, that's a good song. It's not essential, but it's a solid song.
I mean, it's no Will You Be There.
I can tell you, and I'm imagining Mike can probably attest to this, that when that single came out, I remember not being able to keep the single in stock for weeks and weeks and weeks
and
on end.
I think the strange thing about that, about the success of that song, is that that song came out about exactly the same time the molestation accusations were leveled. And, like, that didn't deter people at all.
Well, you know why?
No.
It was because of the whale.
Well, I mean, no one bought the Free Willy soundtrack. But,
No,
fuck no.
And even well, that, too, that didn't that have the Human Nature remix of the SWV track?
SWV, it did.
It did,
really?
That was also available as a single, so you didn't have to worry about it.
Such a simpler time, when you could just buy CD singles.
CD singles are always such a fucking ripoff, though.
That's true.
Even more so than Ka singles.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, back in those days, you were paying $2.99 for 2 songs, essentially. And, you know, nobody felt like they were getting gypped or anything like that. Now, if you ask somebody to pay $2.99 for 2 songs, they're going to be like, what, are you kidding me?
That's sad, true.
I'll steal them, motherfuckers.
Paying for music?
Who does that anymore?
I do.
But, I mean, I think, too, you know, you mentioned the accusations and not deterring that single. I mean, my recollection, it might have just been, you know, also being a huge fan at the time as well, but I think when those accusations first came out, my recollection was that, by and large, people, their initial reaction was disbelief.
Right.
To sort of reject it. And then, of course, as things drew on, you know, we lost a lot of people to the other side, so to speak. But
right,
I think people were quicker to dispute those charges than to accept them the first
time. Oh yeah, initially people were like, no way in hell.
Yeah. Yeah, and I distinctly remember, because you think that was also around the time that, you know, it was like the OJ trial. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, all of that was going on. So it was, you know, there potential for lots of focus on it and lots of, you know, exposés, and there was, and it was still, it was disbelief. But it was Michael Jackson.
That
Michael
never
Jackson doesn't
went
hurt kids.
Away.
He
that,
loves kids.
Growing, you know, a mass of people that were completely convinced that he did nothing wrong. And you think of all the people of the 90s, particularly the 90s and 2000s, who were convicted. There was never as much of an outcry. Like, let me put it this way. If Paul Rubens went to trial tomorrow, people would not be releasing doves every time, you know, he was convicted not guilty of something.
Par, you were talking about the potential for disbelief with the accusations initially.
Yeah, it was basically, to sum it up, you know, at the time, you know, with OJ and all this other stuff, I mean, there was the culture was, you know, looking for every rock, and despite that all, there was, you know, a general disbelief that, you know, it's Michael Jackson, right? Doesn't love, or, you know, doesn't hurt kids. He loves kids. He, you know, he built an amusement park at his house so he could have kids there. You know, it's yeah, and I think that it's interesting, because as that waned, and as that support waned, at least in the States, and that's the thing, you know, we have a very U.S.-centric view of this. Worldwide, that didn't happen.
Right, right.
You know, other countries in the world, they still, you know, looked at him the same way.
I wonder then what audiences outside of the U.S. thought of the documentary in 2003, because that was Martin Bashir, who is British, of British residency, I guess. And I wonder if anyone thought.
Well, it was a BBC documentary, now.
Was it?
Initially,
I guess.
I think it might have been, or it was produced in conjunction with the BBC, because Bashir worked for the BBC.
Yeah,
that's right. But yeah, and they never really waned. I mean, do you think of the example I always go to from a content perspective is the Visionary box set that came out in 06 or 07. The, you know, 20 dual discs. There's a dead format.
Mike, it was never a live format.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, that never really happened. We just pretend. We pretend, and then we hide the dual discs that we have.
We all had our copies of Rob Thomas's first solo album.
Oh yeah, shit! I forgot about that.
I don't own a copy of Rob Thomas's first solo
don't
album.
Don't lie.
I do, however, own a copy of Dave Matthews Band Stand Up
disc,
and I believe that is the only one that I own.
I will gleefully, well, not gleefully, but I will non-embarrassingly admit to owning both. On dual disc.
I think I just have the Rob Thomas one, and I think the first two John Mayer records were reissued as dual discs.
Right.
And one of the quirky documentary footage that he included. So we talked about some favorites, some least favorites. How about from the video angle? Of course, a large portion of Michael Jackson, talking about Michael Jackson, focuses on the visual. Are there any moments that stick out, either television appearances or just videos in general, that stick out either in a good or a bad way?
But, and I think I told you guys this a couple weeks ago, that the only reason I purchased the Thriller 25 download from iTunes was because it included the Motown 25 Billie Jean performance, because that, you know, that was one of those, you know, turning points, right? It was Michael, and just insane, that the dancing and the moonwalk, and you're like, what, the moonwalk, just the moonwalk alone. You know, the thought of you're just gliding across the stage and no one can figure it out. And I remember vividly, days, weeks, we'd all be out on the, you know, the basketball courts trying to figure out in vain how to moonwalk and falling all over ourselves. And, you know, here's these, you know, these, gosh, I was, you know, I guess I was 9 at the time, you know, trying to moonwalk. Yeah, it's nuts to think that.
It's moments like that when you wish you're friends with Alfonso Ribeiro.
So not only would you be able to do the moonwalk, but you'd be able to do the Carlton, too.
That was still a couple years off, but you're absolutely right.
Everyone can do the Carlton.
I actually, you know, not to pat myself on the back, but I cannot take myself out of rhythm so much to be able to do the Carlton. But yeah, I mean, in terms of television moments, I mean, I think the peak for me was probably Motown 25 as well. I mean, I was 6 when that aired on TV, and like I remember the night before it aired, we'd gotten a VCR for the first time, and you know, it was like, you know, go to bed at your regular time, and then when you come home from school tomorrow, we'll let you watch Michael Jackson. And thankfully, you know, I was living with my grandparents and aunts at the time, who took pity on me and allowed me to stay up and actually watch Motown 25, you know, live. Well, not live, because it had been taped 2 months early before it aired, but allowed me to watch it that night. And I mean, that performance was just, I mean, spellbinding. I mean, even all this time later, as many times as I've seen it, like, whenever that comes on TV, like, or even like a clip of it somewhere, I'm riveted. Like, it's still amazing to watch.
Yeah, which is funny, because it's totally lip sync too, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's so much about the performance, you know. And
oh,
that says a lot about. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, if things like if blogs and Twitter and all that stuff was around in 2011, everybody would be like, "Oh, he lip synced. He didn't sing live. You know, he's untalented." Blah 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 blah.
We also wouldn't be having this conversation, probably.
True.
Yes, this is true.
Because, you know, obviously he owes a great deal of his cultural fortune to the monoculture.
Right, right, right. You're absolutely right. I mean, but even prior to Motown 25, I mean, you know, I mean, I was fortunate enough to be sort of aware of things during the Off the Wall era, and he was a lot more accessible during that time than he was afterwards. I mean, you know, he was on the American Music Awards. He did TV specials. He was on, like, a Disney special. He did, like, an interview on 2020. He was on, like, a Diana Ross special. Like, he wasn't reclusive. Like, a Michael Jackson performance on television was an event, but it wasn't, like, a rarity.
And I'm just thinking of the one, and it's funny you mentioned the reclusive thing. There's one, and it's not it's something that only the internet age would bring to light, and for those of you paying attention, maybe we'll link it in the show notes. There is a video of a James Brown.
Right.
Yes.
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 That was literally one of the first 10 things, I think, when YouTube sort of caught on. You know, you read features in magazines about YouTube, and they're like, "You gotta watch this."
Yeah, yeah, and he pulls Prince mm-hmm. up on stage, and then he pulls up Michael Jackson, and you think of that moment, and there were a lot of people in that crowd that thought they were the only people in the world
that
would ever get
yep.
to see that.
Absolutely,
that's right,
suckers.
Although,
and thanks to the internet, we
see
can
it exactly.
See it.
Although, Michael, I will say it's probably more of Prince's moment, because Michael didn't come onto stage on the back of a big chick.
Well, Michael...
Nor did he knock down a stage pro.
Right, exactly. Michael's all...
Nor did he take his shirt off.
But you're absolutely right. And I think YouTube, I think, is to be credited, for me at least, for seeing the rest of Motown 25, which, of course, everyone remembers him on, you know, him doing Billie Jean. And what's less remembered is the 6 minutes or so before that, which was his first performance with all six mm-hmm. Jackson brothers since probably 1975.
That is actually not true.
It
is not true. The Jacksons did an episode of Midnight Special in 1979 where they're performing songs from Destiny, and Jermaine performed with them.
Really?
Yep.
Is that on YouTube?
Yes. That's how I found it.
We'll have to link that.
Right. Because, I mean, I thought the same thing. I thought it was the first time that Michael had performed with you know, his other five brothers since the Jackson 5 left Motown. But, you know, I was just kind of like, you know, screwing around on YouTube, and I looked up this Midnight Special performance of them singing Destiny, I think. Lip-syncing, so Jermaine didn't have to be there, but he was there.
Well, I will say that if it wasn't the first time since, it's definitely the last time, because, you know, Michael's appearance in, say, the torture video was courtesy of Madame Tussauds.
Yes. Well, I mean, after that, there was... I mean, the only other televised... Well, there were no other televised performances by Michael and all of his brothers, unless you count that stupid Jackson Family Honor special from, like, 1994.
Yeah, I was going to say that... That the I remember that, and I remember it being a big deal, and I remember watching it and thinking, this is really just not a big deal.
It wasn't a big deal. I mean, I think, you know, for me being an obsessive, I think it was more telling just by virtue of what didn't happen. Like, Michael sang for, like, 10 seconds. There was also Janet performing at the very, very beginning of the show and then not appearing at all for the rest of the show.
Yeah.
What did Michael sing? Was that... my least favorite Jackson song of all time.
I think it was like a group sing-along, and they gave Michael the microphone for like 10 seconds, and, you know, he sang like two lines and then just handed the microphone back to somebody else.
Yeah.
This makes me think of, if you've ever read the J. Randy Tarabrelli book, Michael Jackson, The Magic and the Madness, the incredibly bizarre story of the, the North Korean Unification Church?
The Moonies.
Sung,
yeah.
Yes, trying to get him. They were going to do some sort of Korean tour, and they wanted to strong arm Michael into it. I mean, that book is heavily recommended if you want some of the more bizarre, without being icky and sordid, stories of.
I mean, there's some
Michael, particularly the Victory Tour.
There's still some icky and sordid stuff in there. I mean, if you get there are two versions of the book. There is one that was published in 1990.
I think there's three, actually.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, you're right. There's three. There's one that was published in 1990. There was one that was published right after the after he was acquitted in trial. And the third one was published right after he passed away. You know, the icky stuff is in the later volumes. But even the first edition of the book is really, really a worthwhile read. Because it talks for the first time about, like, Joe having an illegitimate child. It talks about Jackie having an affair with Paula Abdul. Like, there's some pretty interesting stuff in there.
Absolutely. And I have nothing but criticism for every volume afterward, particularly because if you've ever read the second or third edition, Dangerous completely swept under the rug.
Oh, yeah, he
it
basically
really goes from 90 to 93.
Yeah, he ignores pretty much the... I mean, except for his marriage to Lisa Marie, it pretty much ignores the 90s.
Well, the musical side of the
right,
90s.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Now, of course... Just as notable a moment for any Michael Jackson fan as when they first discovered him was when the news broke 2 years ago that he had passed. I wondered if anyone wanted to touch on that, perhaps, if they had any particular recollections from a cultural standpoint.
Yeah. This is very bizarre. One of my best friends and I had been planning. We talked about doing this for years, and we finally got down to it. And the day after Michael died, we finally got... We were going to throw a 20th anniversary of Purple Rain party at a club in Pittsburgh. So we're all psyched for this. And then the day before, I'm getting my friend's brother from the airport, and I get a text message from one of my other good friends, like, hey, is Michael Jackson dead? And, of course, my first instinct is, or whatever, you know, like, probably not. But whatever. And then start flipping through the radio dial and, you know, start then when we get to his apartment, flip on CNN, and they, you know, eventually confirmed it. You know, just a really sort of bizarre thing. And then we went to out to dinner, and of course the first thing I did was put like $10 in the jukebox and played a bunch of Michael Jackson tracks. I mean, and then, you know, we were still going out to promote our Prince thing that night, and then we ended up at an 80s night, and of course the DJ was playing a lot of Michael, and it was one of the I couldn't think of a better sort of situation to have been in at that moment than I wrote about this in my initial blog sort of reflection than being, you know, on a dance floor with, you know, a few dozen other people dancing and clapping and sing, you know, Momose Momosama Makusa in unison. You know, it just felt like it felt like the most appropriate sort of way to, you know, sort of acknowledge what had happened. But definitely very bizarre. And you know, I get, you know, upset or you know, reflective when musicians or artists that I really admire pass, but I generally I'm able to just sort of like, oh, whatever. But I was really, you know, not to the point of, you know, depression or not leaving the house, but I was more emotionally sort of affected by his passing than I would have expected. And I remember the day after, because I was stayed at my parents' house that night, and I walked into, you know, the living room. My mom was just sitting there watching Michael Jackson videos on MTV, and like, you know, she's in as much shock as I am. That was sort of like a moment for me where I'm like, you know, we, as a child of the '80s, like to think, you know, I grew up with Michael Jackson. Like, she grew up with Michael Jackson, you know,
yeah.
And that was just like a really weird sort of connection / sad sort of moment. I don't know. I'm done.
I'm trying to think. I remember vividly. I was listening to George Harrison.
Whoa, weird.
Oh, man.
And it's just such a strange thing. I was listening to George Harrison. I had just ripped my promo copy of The Greatest Hits that I was writing up for Popdose, and it was, you know, oh, he's been rushed to the hospital, and I had to go and pick my wife up from the train station. I remember turning on the radio, and I went and picked her up, and I was like, yeah, it's really strange. You know, they just brought Michael Jackson to the hospital, and, you know, no one knows what's going on. And I remember coming home, you know, turning on CNN and just basically, you know, for the next few hours, just being transfixed to it. And I remember that was the moment that TMZ became a legitimate
right.
source of
right.
information, because, you know, like them or hate them or whatever, Harvey Levin is not a stupid man, and he will not print anything that's not
right.
verified. And they were the first to say it, and it was like, whoa. Whoa.
Yeah.
Is that real? And you had to question it, right? Because it was on the internet, but CNN wasn't
right.
saying it. And, you know, Fox wasn't saying it, MSNBC wasn't saying it. It was just TMZ, and you're like, oh. I just remember the very icky feeling of, you know, that wave of, oh yeah, this really happened, and yeah, and then, you know, the weeks and months afterwards, you know, I remember vividly, you know. It was strange that, you know, the only song I wanted to hear was "Man in the Mirror," and to this day, that is the single song that I hold in the, you know, if I'm going to be reflective, if I'm going to think mm-hmm. about Michael, that's the song that plays in my head.
I don't, but actually for a very different reason. I was at the time. I'm choosing my words very carefully because I don't know what will be worth saying. Well, I was interning with Universal at the time, and I worked in the catalog department with Motown, and of course that box set, the Hello World box set, had just come out, and, you know, so you hear some of that stuff, and then all of a sudden, you know, once you found out, oh my god, Michael is not with us anymore, that's what I sort of dived into, I went backwards. Because I guess I'd known the epic stuff like the back of my hand. I still do. But that was, for me, the moment was rediscovering all those tracks. And Universal certainly acquiesced. I mean, there was a lot of posthumous chronicling with Motown, with, you know, the stripped mixes and the other remixes. And
yeah, they jumped in pretty quick.
It was very strange.
Yeah.
And then hearing all the, you know, hearing some of the outtakes that, you know, some were eventually released and plenty more weren't.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I remember the entire day pretty vividly. I, without going into specifics, had been having a very, very bad day, even before all of this happened. It's terrible to say, but I remember at one point, like, early in the afternoon going, you know, the only way this day could get anybody worse is if somebody died. And
way to go, Mike, you killed
me. Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Asshole.
Yeah.
Well, no, not to be fair, because, you know, and we all forget, and this is awful. I was just reminded of this earlier today. I was, for whatever reason, Access Hollywood was on, and was reminded that Farrah Fawcett passed away on that same day,
exactly,
that same morning.
That is correct.
That's true.
But I got a phone call, like, you know, maybe 3 or 3:30 from my friend George, who was running a site that I was working on at the time. And we were talking, and just at the end of the conversation, almost as an aside, he was like, oh, did you hear that Michael's got rushed to the hospital? And, I mean, this sort of thing had happened before, where Michael was about to do a show, and then all of a sudden he, you know, something bizarre happened, and he ended up, going into the hospital for a couple of days. So I didn't really think anything of it. And then maybe like an hour after that, the report started coming in that he had died. And again, it was not on CNN. It wasn't on like any reputable news network. So it was kind of hard to determine how valid any of the reports were. But, you know, eventually, you know, it was reported as true. And the interesting thing for me, I think, is that I was not as emotionally devastated by the death of Michael Jackson as I thought I would be. And I think there are two reasons behind that. One is that I think, you know, I mean, again, this kind of sounds bad, but I think I was so numb from what had happened earlier in the day that it didn't affect me as much. It was almost like, you know, that stuff happened to sort of take my focus away from what was going to happen. And this is going to be even more horrible to say, the other reason is because I sort of felt like Michael had been dead for a couple of years already. You know, I think I had already kind of sort of gone through the mourning process because, you know, I mean, he hadn't released an album in 8 years. There was the whole trial and everything, and then just the reports of, like, him being pushed around in a wheelchair and being, like, really frail, and you hadn't heard anything from him. So it was just kind of like, almost kind of like the other shoe dropping for me.
So I hate to ask the question, in retrospect, seeing this is it, seeing how strong he appeared, seeing, you know, how incredible that show was going to be, did that kind of circle around after the fact?
To a degree. I mean, I honestly, and again, like, I feel like I'm getting into sort of like psychobabble talk here. Like, I just feel like it hasn't hit me yet. Like, it hasn't totally hit me yet.
Got it.
And even there are some times, like, I'll catch myself listening to him, and, like, in the middle of a song, I'll just go, like, oh, shit, he's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't hit for me immediately either, although I don't think for the same reasons. But I remember people on Facebook sort of coming out of the woodwork, because, like I said, you know, at the time, when I first came into, like, Michael Jackson, it wasn't cool. You know, there's nothing cool about telling a bunch of your fellow 8th graders listening to Alien Ant Farm's Smooth Criminal, hey, you should hear the original version.
Right.
But a lot of people came out of the woodwork and said, how are you holding up? Because they knew. They knew that it was someone that had mattered to me. And it really, even then, it didn't hit me until the really stereotypical going to work in the city and walking down different blocks in Midtown and hearing different songs blasted at car radios, or seeing a mural drawn on the side of a building. It wasn't until you saw those kind of things, and even, I think, the weirdest moment for me was I went on vacation. We went to Bermuda, and there's a record store in Bermuda, and I'm like, that's pretty cool, a record store. And sure enough, the box set that they had just done for Motown, the Hello World box set, was on sale.
Right.
And I mean, you think, man, you know, this is something really important that we lost.
Right.
And that's what's so interesting, you know, as a fan and as a pop culture geek, that summer, right? you know, obviously under much different circumstances and much more unfortunate circumstances, but that the summer of 2009, if you, you know, were in a, if you were comatose or something and you woke up, you know, in late June after his death and just walking around in the world, you know, it's like, it might as well have been the summer of 1984.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was totally inescapable. You know, the music was once again just so ubiquitous. I mean, similar experiences to Duquette, you know, where in traffic, you know, and you're sort of getting bits of, you know, Billie Jean's beat coming in through your window from other cars, stuff like that, or, you know, the amount of play that he got it, and continues to get now, of course, you know, at various dance nights and things like that, just sort of, you know, it, and there was a sort of, even more so than the day he actually died, you know, there was this sort of, that summer, in those sort of moments, there was, like, this cultural acknowledgement, like, you know, you heard, you pull up next to somebody at a stoplight and they were listening to Michael Jackson, you sort of like, you know, you had this sort of connection with that person, you know what I mean? It's like, is it, the sort of collectivity of it was really sort of interesting to me. I don't know.
No, yeah, that makes sense. And it's a feeling to me that's unfortunately been a little diluted, and I think the reason is, I don't know if it's just basic passage of time and distance, I think a lot of it has to do with the sort of lackluster, I'll say, from the perspective of a catalog enthusiast, the lackluster presentation in many aspects of Michael since then. You know, we've gotten, especially from Sony, where, you know, it's widely accepted that his best work was, you know, as an adult from the 70s to the, you know, 90s, 2000s. There hasn't been a whole lot, you know? There's that, the DVD box set they did last year.
Right.
And then there was the Michael compilation, and, I mean, talk about getting the nostalgia train off on the wrong foot, you know?
The nostalgia train derailed with that album, pretty much.
Without a doubt. Although, in a weird way, you know, it's still a bizarre testament to his legend. After Elvis passed away, or after John Lennon passed away, there were never... You know, I think the... What was it, Milk and Honey, the one record after John Lennon passed away?
Yeah.
Nobody said... You know, those aren't... That's not him.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Right. It's true.
I mean,
or Elvis. Oh, that's not him.
I don't think there would have been any reason to doubt the legitimacy of those records. Whereas, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I listen to certain songs on Michael, and I think I know Michael Jackson's voice fairly well. You know, I've been listening to it for 35 years. And there are certain songs on that album that I really do not think are him. Or not completely him.
Yeah, that first track that they circulate, I forget which one it was.
Breaking News?
Oh, God.
Yeah, and that one, it was like... At that point, and I sort of fell into the, you know, the rest of the blogosphere, but like, it doesn't even really sound... Like, you know, there are tracks where Michael Jackson, you know, especially in the later years, where his voice sounds a little bit different, but you know it's still unmistakably
right.
him. But that track just like... It sounds like a Michael Jackson impersonator.
Right, absolutely.
Have you ever read the liner notes in Michael before they have the lyrics to that song? Like, there's a note, it's like, Michael always used to like to pretend like he was other characters. Like, he'd leave messages on people's answering machines as other characters. And it was
if
like...
by always, you mean after 2002.
It was a really piss-poor way of, you know, saying, of sort of trying to justify, yeah, this doesn't really sound like him.
Right.
You know, and even the tracks that sound like him, that are him, you know, I mean, the biggest missed opportunity for me was Behind the Mask, you know, finally getting that out into the ether, and then it was kind of like weirdly remixed, you know, it was like somebody wailing at the end, you know, and it's like, I don't know, I would have rather heard it like a demo, like a skeletal kind of, you know, that sort of old guitar line and like a wind drum machine or something. Maybe
I'll say this though, the Michael Project, like, you know, pretty much, I think within 2 months of his passing, you know, Sony announced a contract with the estate that they're releasing 6 or 7 albums of material, and the Michael, if the Michael album's any indication, I'm really just not hopeful at all that any of this will be all that interesting.
Right.
I'd be much more interested in hearing some of the stuff that's on, like, the This Is It set or the box set, the Ultimate Collection, where it's actually demos of songs, you know, that we love, rather than this sort of piece together material that he's putting out now.
Yeah, I'd sooner see, of course, the big reissue enthusiast that I am. I'd sooner see reissues of Off the Wall and Bad. I would probably, even though it's going to be like the third reissue for Thriller if they ever did another version, I always thought they could do like a box set, maybe not like the Pet Sounds box set where it's like just raw material.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid it's more going to be like electronically processed like demos. Like, you know, they take his actual backing tracks and then just have like they just punch people in, kind of like Sinatra, like the last couple Sinatra records.
I have sort of two thoughts on this, where it's like, one, yeah, the production that's done without him there, you know, the remixing and everything is problematic. And also, like, I'm after Michael, I'm wondering, you know, A, him being such a perfectionist, and B, I get the sense that he's not the same as a figure like a Springsteen or a Prince, where they had, you know, their unreleased material, some of their best material, right?
Well, a lot of it's funny that a lot of unreleased material, particularly from like the Dangerous era, has already surfaced. There's stuff all over the place that he completed that just didn't get released.
And even, I think Dangerous, because I remember when they remastered everything in 2001. They were, mm-hmm. I think Dangerous was supposed to be a 2-CD set because there was no bonus material.
Right.
And there's like some sort of acetate promo disc, and I think some of that stuff ended up on the box set. But I think isn't there a track with LL Cool J that, you know, there's remains on Surface,
which is really good. I have it. It's actually pretty damn good.
What's that track?
It's called Serious Effect. It's a really good song. I'll send it to you. It's a pretty good song.
Wait, it's on the box set?
Never commercially released.
And that's going to do it for the special bonus episode, but as always, the discussion doesn't end there. What are your favorite Michael Jackson songs, videos, and moments? Leave a comment on the post and join the conversation. If you're new to the show, you can find all our archived episodes on iTunes. Please listen and leave a review. The more ratings and reviews we get, the greater our dominance over pop culture gets. You can also become a fan of Pop Dose on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Pop Dose. And again, thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Mike, Michael, and Zach for joining us. And remember...
Did you see, like, last year at some point, Animal Planet has some show or another, I don't know what the hell it's called, but LaToya went to the wildlife preserve to reunite with Bubbles?
Bubbles! I heard about that.
Oh, God. It's... She, you know, it's funny because she shows up and goes to the cage and goes up to Bubbles and is sort of emotional, you know. I think, Bubbles, you remember me, don't you? And it's so clear that there's, like, no recognition on Bubbles' parts. And he's like, bitch, give me a banana, you know.
Right.
But it's a really bizarre reality TV moment.
That should be the name of the podcast, Bitch, Give Me My Banana.
I think we may have found a tag.
Go. Zach, you hit a home run there.
That's what I do. Those are three glasses of wine from a box will do for you.